Hey, welcome to this episode of Light 'Em Up. We take a deep dive on the criminal justice system, crime scene investigation, and leadership. We enlighten, educate, and empower others with the truth. Like it or not, the truth disturbs, the truth divides, but ultimately, the truth delivers. Hey, I'm your host, Phil Rizzo. I'm the principal owner of Rizzo's Protective Group. We are a high-risk security consulting firm headquartered out of Akron, Ohio, and with offices in the Bronx, New York, and Cerro Alto, the Dominican Republic. As we put the ball on the tee to line things up for kickoff, we speak life, health, and prosperity over each and every one of you, and we want to thank you for joining us. Tonight, on this much-anticipated edition of Light 'Em Up, we'll focus our intensive, investigative, and informative journalistic spotlight on a problem that is often described as an unfortunate, intractable, unavoidable, and a daily reality among the members of law enforcement in the criminal justice system. We'll reveal the story behind the story on testa-lying, when police lie. Blue lies matter. We'll drill deep and offer in-depth insight on how the criminal justice system might improve the truthfulness of police testimony, sharing the four big lies that police often tell. And as education is always an essential component of Light 'Em Up, as a case study, we'll brief and examine another Supreme Court landmark case named Frazier v. Cupp, C-U-P-P, decided in 1969. In this case, the High Court ruled that on its own, police deception in interrogations did not automatically constitute misconduct. We have a small but exclusive vintage audio sampler that we've enhanced and remastered from the Supreme Court's oral argument in Frazier v. Cupp. As we bring the relevance of the law decided decades ago into your listening and educational experience today, and as we educate and empower you with the essential knowledge to keep yourself safe at all times. Hey, the truth is certainly under attack. The truth is well worth fighting for. All this, pero mucho, mucho más aquí y solamente aquí con Light 'Em Up. Hey, it's unfortunate, but police lie. Throughout my lifetime, I've had two law enforcement officers lie on me and about me. One of the most notorious lies that police told happened just a few years ago when the Minneapolis Police Department initially described George Floyd's death in May of 2020 as resulting from a medical incident during police interaction. That account was challenged within hours of a teenager's gruesome video of his death, which flooded the internet, igniting the largest protests in a generation. But police departments all over the world have engaged in and been caught in illegal lying to bolster their arrests. The term testa-lying was coined by police officers in New York City. It usually refers to perjury committed by police officers. However, it has also been used to describe other forms of in-court deception. Like we said at the outset of our show, blue lies matter. You heard it correctly. Blue lies matter. And the lies of the police hurt people. Such lies have the potential to ruin a person's life by putting them in prison for a long, long time, or even taking their life. Now, the word in the Spanish language for the word liar in English is mentira. If you lie with regularity, you are considered to be un mentiroso, if male, or una mentirosa, if female. While the overwhelming majority of law enforcement officers perform their duties with honor and professionalism, those who willfully choose to violate the Constitution and the rights of others should be held accountable. With this episode, we don't intend to argue that police officers, as court witnesses, are generally perjurers and are solely interested in obtaining convictions or are otherwise always dishonest. We would submit that probably most are not. However, the evidence of testa-lying is sufficiently strong enough evidence to where a Brooklyn DA had publicly named seven blacklisted officers whom have been found to not be credible as witnesses to suggest that police officers commit perjury or other forms of testimonial deception more often than the public and juries have realized. Law enforcement officers are bound by an oath to protect all citizens equally. This requires consistency, compassion, and respect for the dignity of all. Now, does every officer who has taken the oath to protect and serve do so? No, of course not. It would be naive to think so. When an officer violates his or her oath, justice demands that he or she pay the price for blatantly disregarding the law and the civil rights of others. As long as police officers feel emboldened by police brass to act more like Dirty Harry or Harry Callahan versus Frank Serpico, violations of the law and testifying, such as is the focus of this episode, will continue unabated. Now, to those who may be apologists for this kind of unlawfulness on the part of the police, the fact of the matter remains that the reputation of the entire law enforcement profession is tarnished when one single solitary officer betrays their oath to protect and serve. That's all it takes. Furthermore, we the people should not tolerate anyone who dishonors the badge by using excessive force, lying under oath, falsifying their paperwork, graft, or doing anything that is contrary to the provisions of the U.S. Constitution and the laws governing our great land. Encounters with the police can be very scary and extremely stressful, even when you've not done anything wrong. Simply look at the case of the Exonerated Five in New York to see how difficult it can be when faced with crooked members of law enforcement. My wife, who is now a U.S. citizen, is originally from the Dominican Republic, a place where, unfortunately, corruption among law enforcement is rampant. One day, we were talking about the way police should interact with a citizen, and she asked me in passing, "Legally, can police lie to citizens?" Now, if someone asked you this question, certainly you would say no, right? When suspects or persons of interest are hauled in for questioning by the police, they are expected to tell the truth. Most people would assume that it's a two-way street, going both ways, that the police must also be truthful during interrogations. But the reality is that the police can lie to you during an interrogation, and it is not uncommon for them to do so. Most law enforcement officers are just people trying to do their jobs to keep people safe by enforcing the law. Sometimes, unfortunately, these good intentions can be overshadowed by other interests or prejudices. Back in the proverbial old days, when dinosaurs roamed the earth, when police officers were set on a pedestal, officers of the law could do no wrong, and you never heard of any wrong that they may have done. Never. In old movies and in our grandparents' memories, the police were always the definition of the good guys, regardless of the context. To be certain, law enforcement officers are still held in high esteem by many, many Americans, and rightfully so. They have a difficult job to do, and most perform honorably and within the bounds of the law, some even heroically. Most children are taught that police officers could be trusted and that they were heroes along with firefighters and members of the armed forces. But the fact remains that police officers are still very much human. They put their pants on one leg at a time, just like everyone else. They have mortgages, kids in college, just like everyone else. And from time to time, they permit their internal biases, which we all have, to show. And this may lead some to believe a person is guilty of a crime without any substantial evidence. And police officers hate to have their egos bruised or their authority challenged. The comply or die mentality that far too many law enforcement officers possess has come into play far more often than anyone would like to admit. In times like these, police officers will go to almost any measure to make sure a person receives a guilty verdict. Officers lose sight of justice for their own versions of street justice, where any means justify the ends. In actuality, the short answer to that previous question, can the police lie to you? The answer to that is yes. The police can lie when asking questions to or interrogating a suspect. They can legally lie to you about having your fingerprints at a crime scene, also having an eyewitness that places you at a crime scene, also the ability to obtain a search warrant, and the severity of your potential sentence. And keep in mind, just for the record, law enforcement is not limited to these four concepts, which they can lie to you about. A good place to always start off when telling a story is at the beginning. So as a proper jumping off point, let's begin by examining in more detail, like we promised, the four big lies that law enforcement can tell you. Whopper number one. Your fingerprints were all over the crime scene. Law enforcement has relied on fingerprint analysis to identify suspects and solve crimes for more than 100 years. Investigators use fingerprints to link a perpetrator to a crime scene. Individual fingerprint identification records have also been used in sentencing, probation, and parole decisions. Hey, we know it's been a while, but we had our very own fingerprint expert on Light 'Em Up during Season 1, Episode 13. That episode was entitled Fingerprints, Mugshots, and Forensics, Behind the Scenes with the San Francisco PD ID Division Supervisory Fingerprint Expert, Renee Rodriguez. And we're very proud to say that Renee has become a dear, dear friend of my family following that specific interview that we shared together. You should take some time to listen to that episode. Trust me when I tell you it was jam-packed with interesting information. With the technology that has advanced tremendously over the years, officers have at their disposal the ability to identify patent, latent, or 3D, or plastic, fingerprints, and oftentimes in the lab, they rely on advanced chemical techniques in order to analyze and visualize fingerprint evidence. The fact of the matter is that police are permitted to lie about physical evidence that does not exist. Again, police officers can tell you that they found your DNA or fingerprints all over a crime scene. The truth is that DNA and fingerprint evidence takes a substantial time to gather and process from crime scene to crime lab in order to analyze before anything ever comes to a courtroom as tagged and marked as evidence to be admitted with supporting testimony and the detailed findings under oath before a judge and a jury. Now you may be thinking, why on earth do police use this specific lie? Well, I'll tell you, it's all about clearing cases. And law enforcement uses this lie to convince you to confess to placing yourself at the scene of a crime. Also, their desired hope is to make you give more information that could be helpful to interrogators and, as we mentioned, secure a conviction and clear the case. The lie can also be used to trick you into surrendering your DNA. Now, it's very important that you heed this warning to be extra, extra careful. Forewarned is forearmed. If you ever find yourself at the police station, expected to answer any questions, if you're offered a cigarette, a can of soda pop, perhaps maybe a cup of coffee, be polite and say thank you, but no thank you. Because your DNA can be extracted from the surfaces of these items with ease. Note well that if your DNA or fingerprints match what was found at the crime scene, this will certainly be used as evidence that may lead to a conviction. You know, while I'm sure we have your attention and you're listening intently, let's keep the progress moving forward. On to big lie number two. We have an eyewitness, so say the police. This is another whopper of a lie that the police can use. Now, studies have shown that mistaken eyewitness testimony accounts for about half of all wrongful convictions. Researchers at The Ohio State University examined hundreds of wrongful convictions and determined that roughly 52% of the errors resulted from eyewitness mistakes. Here's the kicker for you. Police can actually fabricate evidence. That's true. Yes, hold the presses. I'll repeat what I said in the event that you missed it. The police can actually fabricate evidence in order to get you to admit to a crime, despite the fact that you're innocent. Again, but why would police lie? During an interrogation, officers may lie about evidence they have to pressure you into confessing to a crime they believe you have committed, even if you are innocent. To give some context to this fact, all one needs to do is look at the infamous case of the Exonerated Five, previously known as the Central Park Five. the five innocent young men whom the front runner for the Republican nomination for the office of the President of the United States took out a full-page ad in the New York Times calling for the death penalty for those five men who were completely innocent of the crimes with which they were charged. During separate and individual interrogations, police told each of the five teens that the others had implicated them in committing the crime, that their friends had fingered them or ratted them out for the crime, lying to the youths even though the police knew it wasn't true. Trust me when I tell you that it's a sad day for justice when the investigator molds and shapes the evidence, driving the evidence forward rather than permitting the evidence to drive the investigator. Hey, let's focus on big lie number three. We can get a search warrant within minutes. Just let us in. This is another strong bluff that police can use. Now, the fact is that it doesn't take long to get a search warrant. The police can secure a search warrant within 30 minutes or an hour maximum. All they have to do is call a district attorney and a judge and give them strong reasons why they need the warrant, establishing probable cause, which we've talked about in previous episodes. The judge will then take a few minutes to decide whether or not to approve the search warrant. Police who use this lie usually don't believe they have strong reasons to convince the judge to grant the warrant. They'll use this lie, hoping this will result in your compliance. You should always refuse to let the police into your home or car unless they have a current and active search warrant. The U.S. Constitution reminds you of this in the text of the Fourth Amendment. And lastly, but certainly not least in the overall importance, big lie number four. You'll receive a light sentence if you cooperate. If you get arrested, police will tell you that if you cooperate and confess, they'll make sure you get a lenient sentence. Don't fall for this tall tale and bald-faced lie. You had better be very, very careful what you say to interrogators. They have nothing to do with your sentencing. Sentencing comes from a judge. Only a district attorney can help you get a light sentence by recommending one to the sentencing judge. Being open and spilling your guts will only ensure that your words are used against you in some way, shape, form, or fashion. If you want to share information with the police, make sure that you have an adroit criminal defense attorney by your side when sharing that information. And only talk if you say anything at all, strictly upon the advice of your counsel. Your attorney will be working on your side and will ensure that you don't share information that could land you in jail. One thing's important that we want to share with you, and it's important to note that young people are especially vulnerable to falsely confessing under the pressure of police deception and deceptive tactics. In a separate case in the state of Connecticut, police falsely told 16-year-old Bobby Johnson, who had been arrested for the murder of 70-year-old Herbert Fields during an apparent robbery in New Haven in August of 2006, that they had evidence connecting him to the crime and that he was facing the death penalty and he would never see his family again unless he admitted killing Fields. Johnson had an IQ of 69, below the threshold of 70, considered mental impairment, and he broke down and cried as police questioned him. They promised him probation if he confessed. Not only that, they withheld evidence that pointed to other suspects. As a result, he falsely confessed, with police eliciting three different confessions until his story fit the evidence. Johnson was sentenced to 38 years in prison. But through the determined efforts of his lawyer, Kenneth Rosenthal, and the Connecticut Innocence Project, he was freed in 2015 after serving 9 years for a crime he did not commit. Today, there's a growing movement for change in a number of states across the U.S., and we have the power to protect people from police deception by supporting legislation that reduces the risk of false and unreliable confessions. Even though it doesn't seem fair to be lied to about evidence against you, it has been found to be constitutional. Oddly, it's almost always legal and constitutionally permitted for police to lie during interrogations. Given this fact, we're going to shift gears a little bit and examine a case study, another landmark Supreme Court case that pretty much gave the police the green light to lie. We here at Light 'Em Up are honored to be able to bring you a portion of the preserved audio from the oral argument argued on February 26, 1969, in the landmark Supreme Court case, Frazier v. Cupp. Again, Frazier v. Cupp, C-U-P-P, with Chief Justice Earl Warren presiding. Arguing on behalf of the petitioner will be Mr. Howard M. Feuerstein of Portland, Oregon.
Number 643, Frazier, petitioner, versus H.C. Cupp, warden. Mr. Feuerstein?
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I'm Howard M. Feuerstein of Portland, Oregon, representing the petitioner, Martin Rene Frazier, who is a prisoner in the Oregon State Penitentiary, serving a 25-year sentence for second-degree murder. This case involves Frazier's petition for writ of habeas corpus and involves three distinct issues. The first issue is whether Frazier was denied his right of confrontation when the prosecution placed before the jury in its opening statement the confession of a co-indictee who later invoked his Fifth Amendment right not to testify. The second issue is the admissibility of Frazier's written statement and whether that's the obtaining of that statement violated Escobedo versus Illinois, or in the alternative, that statement was involuntarily given. And finally, the case involves an issue of the validity of a search and seizure of certain clothing of Frazier. The district court granted the writ of habeas corpus on the right of confrontation and on the confession issue and did not rule on the search and seizure issue. The warden appealed, and the Ninth Circuit reversed the district court, finding against Frazier on all three issues. This court granted certiorari. If it pleases the court, I'll discuss the facts as they pertain to each issue separately. Frazier and his cousin Rawls were jointly indicted for first-degree murder in the strangulation slaying of one Russell Marlowe. Frazier entered a plea of not guilty, and at the time of Frazier's trial, Rawls had entered the plea of guilty to a reduced charge of second-degree murder and was in jail awaiting sentence on that charge. At Frazier's trial, Frazier's defense attorneys admitted that Rawls, Frazier, and Marlowe were together at the time of Marlowe's death and that an altercation occurred. The defense, however, asserted that it was Rawls that strangled Marlowe and that Frazier had no part in the strangulation. The prosecution, of course, denied this. They had ample evidence placing the three at the secluded scene of the crime. They, of course, had no direct evidence as to who did the strangling because there are no other eyewitnesses.
He was also hit on the head.
That is correct. However, that was not the cause of death. The prosecution primarily tried to impeach Frazier's version of what had transpired. The day in which Frazier's trial was to start, prior to impaneling a jury, the attorneys met with the judge in chambers. At that time, Frazier's attorney informed the district attorney that he'd heard that Rawls had been subpoenaed and that he had just talked to Rawls' attorney and been informed that Rawls would not testify if called to the stand. We know that prior to this time, the district attorney was in possession of conflicting information on whether or not Rawls would testify. A jury was impaneled, and the next day, the district attorney made his opening statement. In the course of the opening statement, he said that the officers had talked to Rawls during their investigation and that the district attorney was going to call Rawls as a witness. At this point, holding Rawls' confession in his hand, the district attorney proceeded to paraphrase that confession. The defense moved for a mistrial after the opening statement, which was denied. Later, the district attorney called Rawls to the stand. Rawls appeared with his attorney and refused to testify. Defense renewed his motion for mistrial, and a hearing was held before the judge. The motion was denied.
Is there any rule in your state that if you're going to introduce evidence along a certain line, you have to mention it in the opening statement.
No, there's no requirement that you
mention
it in the opening statement. No, Your Honor. Yes, it was not referred to as a confession. If you read the opening statement, which is in the appendix on pages 41 to 43, the relevant part, you'll find that, for instance, near the very first, the prosecutor said that it is Rawl's version that such and such occurred. And then he stopped and he says, maybe I'm wrong. I will look here to see as to whether Rawl said that he hit him first. And at other times you have phrases like, Rawl said, or it's Rawl's version. So that there was a clear inference. One, that the officers had talked to Rawls. Two, that Rawls had given his version to the officers. And three, the inference is inescapable that what the district attorney was doing was setting out before the jury what Rawls' version was and what Rawls had told the police.
The written confession itself was never introduced.
That is right. In fact, the defense never saw the written confession until Rawls later changed his plea to not guilty and it was introduced in Rawls' trial. No specific instruction was requested of the judge, and the judge did not give one to disregard these particular comments in the opening statement. The judge did, however, in its general charge to the jury, indicate that statements of counsel are not evidence.
How long was the trial?
Pardon, Your Honor?
How long was the trial?
I think the trial lasted approximately a week. The district court based its decision on this court's opinion in Douglas versus Alabama. The court may recall in that case, the prosecutor, by means of leading questions, placed the accomplice's confession before the jury while the accomplice was on the stand asserting the Fifth Amendment. The Ninth Circuit and the warden wished to distinguish Douglas versus Alabama and the later case of Bruton versus United States on the ground that here the prosecutor acted in good faith and that the statement was not unfairly prejudicial to the defendant. We submit, however, that the rule under Douglas and Bruton is that where the prosecution places the substance of an accomplice's confession before the jury, and the defendant is denied the right of confrontation if that is not subject to cross-examination. We submit that the defendant is just as surely denied his right to confront and cross-examine Rawls, whether or not the prosecution acted in good faith or in bad faith or was merely negligent in placing this before the jury.
This case gave the green light to the police to lie. When the police lie, typically the lie is combined with particular details that only the perpetrator would know. By telling this kind of lie, the investigators hope this will get you to give a confession. When the police tell you as fact that they have evidence against you, make sure you do not admit to anything. Remember your Miranda rights. Even when you're innocent and trying to answer to the best of your ability, do not give away any information without speaking first with your attorney. Now, at this point, you may be thinking, are there any limits on this process? Even as deceptive interrogation practices are generally allowed by law, they are not without limits. Before the investigators lie or use tricks on you, they must read the suspect his or her Miranda rights, which, as you know from watching many police shows on TV, include the right to remain silent during the interrogation or questioning. Anything you say can be used against you. The right to a court-appointed attorney. If you can't afford one, one will be appointed to you at no cost. The police can only use a lie or trick if they are sure that that lie or trick is not reasonably likely to produce a false confession. Trust me when I tell you that there are more lies that police use regularly. The ones we've highlighted above are just some of the most common tactics. If you find yourself under arrest, be certain to remember the rights that you do have. More lawyers are suing the police than ever before. But as we've learned from prior episodes of Light 'Em Up, suing a city, government agency, or police officer comes with additional challenges for plaintiffs, such as the qualified immunity doctrine that shields government officials in some situations. But it seems that plaintiffs are winning more and more verdicts, and oftentimes bigger than ever before. In the landmark Supreme Court case, Frazier v. Cupp, 394 U.S. 731, 1969. For those who may not know, the petitioner was Martin Rene Frazier, who was a prisoner in the Oregon State Penitentiary, serving a 25-year sentence for second-degree murder. During the interrogation, police falsely informed Frazier that his co-defendant had already confessed and implicated him in the murder. Frazier denied any involvement in the crime and suggested speaking with an attorney, but police continued to question him. The police elicited a confession from him, which was used against him at trial. And also, for those who may not know, the Latin legal term habeas corpus refers to the great writ of habeas corpus, which is a fundamental right in the Constitution that protects against unlawful and indefinite imprisonment. Translated from Latin, it means, "Show me the body." Habeas corpus has historically been an important instrument to safeguard individual freedom against arbitrary executive power. Stemming directly from police lies in the handling of Frazier's case early on, Frazier brought this habeas corpus proceeding and claims that his constitutional rights were violated in three respects in his trial in 1965 for murder, for which he had been indicted jointly with his cousin, a man by the name of Jerry Lee Rawls, R-A-W-L-S, who pleaded guilty to the same offense. Frazier's first argument centers on certain allegedly prejudicial remarks made during the prosecutor's opening statement. First off, the prosecutor, on the basis of previous information he had received that Jerry Lee Rawls would testify to, included in his opening statement a brief summary of Rawls's expected testimony. When Rawls was called to the stand, he claimed his Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination and was dismissed. Frazier's motions for a mistrial were overruled. The trial court instructed the jury that the opening statements of counsel should not be considered as evidence. Secondly, after preliminary questioning, shortly after his arrest, Frazier was told that he could have an attorney if he wanted one, and that anything that he said could be used against him at trial. Thereafter, the interrogating officer falsely told Frazier, who was reluctant to talk, that Jerry Lee Rawls had confessed. Frazier later began to sing like a canary and spill the details of his story, but again showed signs of reluctance, and he said he thought he better get a lawyer before he talked any more. Following the officer's reply that Frazier could not be in any more trouble than he was in, he fully confessed, and, after further warnings, signed a written confession, which was later admitted into evidence over his objection. His third claim, also admitted into evidence, was some clothing which officers had seized from Frazier's duffel bag, which he and Jerry Lee Rawls had used jointly, and which the officers had found during a search conducted with Rawls' consent. Frazier was convicted, and the state Supreme Court affirmed. He thereafter filed a petition for a writ of habeas corpus in the district court, which granted the writ. The Court of Appeals reversed. Frazier's claims that the prosecutor's use of the summarized statement by Jerry Lee Rawls denied him his constitutional rights of confrontation as guaranteed by the 6th and 14th Amendments, that his confession contravened the principles established by Escobedo v. Illinois, 378 U.S. 478, 1964, and Miranda v. Arizona, 384 U.S. 436, 1960. And was involuntary, and that the clothing had been illegally seized in violation of the 4th and 14th Amendments. Frazier appealed his conviction to the United States Supreme Court on three main points. The defense argued Frazier was denied his Sixth Amendment right to cross-examine the prosecution's witness, Rawls, because Rawls refused to answer questions after the prosecution referenced elements from his prior statements to the police. The defense claimed under Escobedo v. Illinois and Miranda v. Arizona, Frazier was denied his right to counsel during his interrogation because of the fact that questioning continued after he suggested speaking with an attorney. The defense also claimed Frazier's confession was involuntary and should have been suppressed. The defense argued evidence used against Frazier was obtained during an illegal search of a gym bag used jointly by Frazier and Rawls. The court stated the trial judge followed necessary protocol by instructing the jury to disregard the references to Rawls' statements. The court agreed the prosecution did not emphasize Rawls' statements over other evidence, and the statements alone were not touted to the jury as a crucial part of the prosecution's case. The court ruled Frazier did not formally request an attorney, as required for Escobedo v. Illinois, to apply, and Miranda v. Arizona did not apply because the original took place in 1965, 1 year before Miranda. The court also ruled that the statement on its own did not render the confession involuntary based on a totality of the circumstances view. The court dismissed the illegal search argument, citing consent was legally obtained from Rawls and his mother. The court ruled Rawls, a co-owner of the gym bag, was authorized to give consent to search the bag, even though items in certain compartments of the bag belonged to Frazier. The Supreme Court held and ruled in Frazier v. Cupp in 1969 that police officers can lie during an investigation as long as it does not shock the conscience of the court or the community. It wrote that the fact that the police misrepresented the statements that Rawls had made is, while relevant, insufficient, in our view, to make this otherwise voluntary confession inadmissible. As we mentioned before, though, there are some limits to the lies that police can tell. For instance, they can't tell someone that they'll lose custody of their children if they don't confess, as was the case in Linnum v. Illinois, 372 U.S. 528, 1963. But they most certainly can lie about a lot of things that can intimidate people into confessing to crimes they didn't commit. There are few more terrifying propositions than a person spending time in prison for a crime that they did not commit. Even worse than convicting an innocent person is the possibility that he or she may be sentenced to death despite being factually innocent. What if the only thing that caused a jury to convict you were the lies of a police officer, or anyone for that matter? What if that person only told those lies to curry favor with the government because they were covering for their own wrongdoings or because of malice towards you? What if that person was a police officer? Who are they going to believe, you or the cop? In the 1980s, an infamous Chicago police superintendent named John Burge uttered the phrase, "Who are they going to believe, you or me?" He went on to torture Andrew Wilson, who had just been arrested for killing two Chicago police officers in cold blood. In a locked police interrogation room, Burge was trying to obtain a confession from Wilson by attaching metal clips to Wilson's ears and other body parts, which were then charged with electricity. Again, Superintendent Burge taunted Wilson with the statement, "Who are they going to believe, you or me?" Hey, we can only hope that today our justice system provides multiple safeguards to protect individuals from what happened to Wilson. But in some respects, it still has fallen short. As long as the court determines that a confession was voluntary and not obtained through violence, the court could allow it, even if it contains falsehoods, especially those by police officers. Later, case law has interpreted Frazier v. Cupp as the case permitting police deception during interrogations. The language of the ruling did not specifically state which forms of police deception were acceptable, But the ruling provided a precedent for a confession being voluntary even though deceptive tactics were used. There are far too many confession-driven practices that exploit weaknesses and lack dignity. Police should be banned from lying to suspects during interrogation. False confessions continue to result in wrongful convictions. Trust must be restored between police and the public served. In conducting research for this episode, we spoke with a detective and investigative supervisor out of northern New Jersey who asked that we maintain his anonymity and didn't use his name for our interview. He stated that he had been a police officer for 25 years as a detective and investigative supervisor. He said that he used deception to obtain confessions from subjects he believed were guilty. He said, "I knew it was permissible. I thought it was effective, and I saw it as a means to a justifiable end. I now believe I was wrong." Deception can lead vulnerable people to confess to crimes they did not commit. We must now accept that change is needed. Non-coercive information gathering techniques that are effective, humane, and used by police around the world should be adopted here in the United States. Anything else is just unacceptable. The British Parliament has recognized that deceptive police practices yield false confessions and, thus, wrongful convictions. The Police and Criminal Evidence Act of 1984 addresses this concern by establishing clear rules for the police to follow and by empowering courts to enforce those rules. Only positive effects can flow from that courageous change. When lying was banned, thereby removing the opportunity to invent evidence, forensic evidence was more widely used, training improved, and gradually coerced false confessions ceased. A ban on lying to suspects is a significant step forward in criminal justice and law enforcement. The investigator who lies about evidence loses credibility, risks false confessions, and undermines the appearance of fairness in court. To those that are on the job, you do not need to lie to get confessions. To the interview training companies in the U.S. that still promote deception, it's time to move on. To prosecutors, police will follow your lead if you would have the courage to advise them accordingly. Truth is something to be leveraged, not concealed. Engaging with a suspect in a forthright manner elicits key information disclosures. The fact of the matter is that timely, accurate, relevant, objective, thorough, and diligent investigative work and skilled interviewing techniques will reliably uncover the facts, even in complex cases, without lying or diluting the public's trust. In contrast, misleading individuals as to the nature and or extent of the evidence increases the incidence of false confessions, an insidious phenomenon that continues to plague this nation. Using evidence-based practical tools is essential to the process. When a credible authority figure lies to a suspect about evidence, those lies can produce contaminated statements from the guilty party and false confessions from the innocent. It's fruit of the poisonous tree. The risks, as we stated, are even greater with youthful suspects. Trust is essential to police, community relations, and public safety. The use of deceptive tactics can only serve to undermine those relationships. Because of these tactics, otherwise good cases are derailed and still others go unsolved. Trust me when I tell you, no one will talk to you if they don't trust you. Let's talk about some things we could do to try to reduce police testifying. As my dear friend Dr. Sandy Womack Jr. would say, education is the key. In each element of the criminal justice system, police, prosecutors, defense counsels, and judges must unite in order to work together to solve this problem. Lying under oath needs to be a more serious crime. The first step in an effort of reducing the incidence of testifying would be a graduated educational approach. Officers should learn from their mistakes and receive appropriate rewards for following the rules. The public prosecutor is in a position to deal with testifying. prosecutors should decline to prosecute cases they believe are based on unconstitutional evidence. In preparing police witnesses for trial, prosecutors can ensure that officers do not misunderstand their preparation as a go-ahead for perjury through boilerplate testimony. Prosecutors should not tolerate testifying, no matter how small the lie is or infrequent the occurrence. It's been suggested that we should put body-worn cameras on plainclothes officers like anti-crime units, gang squads, and detectives. For decades, these units have been associated with the very aggressive style of street patrol. Rather than running from call to call, like a radio car, and street patrol, anti-crime units conduct their operations in unmarked cars, just like the Uniform Patrol Division does, looking for suspicious activity. These units conduct an outsized number of stops of pedestrians and motorists, and they find an outsized number of drugs and weapons. Outfitting the street crime units with body-worn cameras would add a level of transparency and credibility to the work done by these officers on a daily basis. When a uniformed cop makes a stop or an arrest, there is sometimes a victim or a witness whose testimony proves to be helpful in the case. But anti-crime officers typically stop people on the basis of their own observations of suspicious activity. In this process, their cases will immediately trigger a Fourth Amendment challenge, testing whether the stop and search were lawful, with no body-worn cam footage to support, substantiate, or back up the probable cause in order to make the arrest. An offshoot of this is that cases are made solely on the basis of officer testimony. The video and audio do not lie. Everyone could see the beating that Rodney King took. Having video evidence, being able to see how a specific stop began and unfolded, would benefit judges, as in too many cases to count, judges have expressed skepticism about whether they've gotten the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth from the story that the plainclothes officers tell on the witness stand. Also, judges could hold more suppression hearings. A suppression hearing is a proceeding conducted before a criminal trial judge that involves a motion to suppress or exclude evidence from being used at trial. Almost always, suppression hearings are conducted before the criminal trial begins. In federal criminal proceedings, Rule 41H of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure governs motions of this sort. Most states have similar rules of procedure and conduct similar suppression hearings. You might be thinking, what happens at a suppression hearing? Suppression hearings, which come before the trial, as we stated, are often used to test the constitutionality of the police officer's conduct. They're somewhat more common than trials, but still are far too rare in the criminal justice system. Police officers take the witness stand in open court in far fewer cases than one may expect. The large majority of arrests result in plea deals or a dismissal. In these hearings, judges scrutinize the credibility of the police and their accounts of the facts. After the defense counsel files a motion to suppress evidence in the case, the judge will set a date and time for a hearing. Often, the judge will also allow prosecutors to file a response to the motion. At the hearing, a mini-trial will occur before the judge. No jury is present. Attorneys for the prosecution and the defense are present along with witnesses and the criminal defendant. Usually, the witnesses are the law enforcement officials who were involved in collecting the evidence that is the subject of the motion to suppress. The prosecution has the burden of showing that the evidence was collected without violation. Judges often will reach their conclusions based on the consistency or inconsistency of an officer's sworn testimony. A judge can point out contradictions if flagrant enough. This often offers the best chance for getting at the truth of how an arrest or investigation truly transpired. We don't want bad arrests. Bad arrests are unconstitutional. More suppression hearings would be a good thing. Many agree. Yet still the justice system is reluctant to hold them. It's not unusual for prosecutors to offer very attractive, sweetheart plea deals shortly before a suppression hearing, with the caveat that the defendant takes the deal immediately. Trust me when I tell you, it can be mind-boggling why a defendant is getting such a good deal all of a sudden. There's plenty of evidence that shows that prosecutors have had sufficient time to meet with all the officers involved, and they know that something in their case smells and just doesn't sound right. Their hope is that the offer that they make will make it go away. Oftentimes, it does. We need to stop turning a blind eye towards this kind of corruption. Jail a few police officers who do this kind of thing, and it will send a stronger message that this won't be tolerated. The reluctance on the part of police departments to properly and adequately police their own invites Department of Justice oversight and is just as much a part of the problem as the lies told themselves. While it's impossible to tally the total such number of cases where police officers are found to be perjuring themselves, however, one thing is very clear. Those officers whose testimony came under suspicion experienced very little to almost no impact to their careers. In fact, after a deep, deep review, most were almost always promoted up the ranks. When we raise the expectations of how law enforcement is supposed to act on the job, officers should only have one option, and that is to level up and meet those standards or suffer the consequences. You can't have a court system whereby some people are expected to tell the truth, but others, specifically police officers, are okay to lie if needed. The Supreme Court has already stacked the deck in favor of law enforcement because they have a difficult job that often requires them to make split-second life and death decisions. Decisions that insulate and favor the police. Those are simply the facts, and I'm not anti-cop. But if we're being honest and serious about making improvements to policing and to the criminal justice system as a whole, then we need to root out the culture of dishonesty and increase the transparency and accountability. Far too many remain shrouded by police secrecy laws. Union contracts prevent discipline. While the merits of individual cases are debatable, the overall record cries out for action. If we throw up our hands and say that nothing can be done because it has always been this way, then we, too, are accomplices to the process. Willfully ignoring falsehoods and outright lying is a terrible example to set and to show officers. While muddy water is often cleared with time and by leaving it alone, a cesspool never cleans itself. Permitting telling lies to be the same as telling the truth just breeds a culture of dishonesty that has brought us testifying and the present-day reality where cops who were once revered are now held in contempt and treated with suspicion due to the damage that they themselves have done to their reputations. No one else is to blame for this other than law enforcement themselves. Hey, I'm Phil Rizzo, and you've got Light 'Em Up.
Hey, I want to thank my friends at Innisfree for their promotional products and underwriting. Their fresh-squeezed, hydrating green tea, loaded with amino acids and antioxidants, help replenish and neutralize skin for that natural glow. You want to know the best part? Their tea is organically grown and chosen for skincare from 3,301 Korean native green tea varieties. The winning 1-2-3 punch combination consists of the youth enhancing serum with black tea. Then you just dap a little bit of the eye serum underneath your eyes, and finally the enhancing cream. Oh my goodness. Like Muhammad Ali used to say, I'm pretty. I'm still pretty. They offer innovative beauty solutions for men, also powered by the finest natural ingredients responsibly sourced from Korea's pristine Jeju Island. Their proprietary extraction methods preserve the purity and potency of these wholesome ingredients from plant to bottle to your skin, offering advanced formulas that safely address all skin concerns without the use of harmful chemicals and preservatives. With the wonders of nature at the heart of Innisfree, they take care to preserve and protect the environment in all that they do. We want to thank our friends at Innisfree for their promotional products and underwriting of Light 'Em Up.
Hey, don't forget to subscribe to us on YouTube and Instagram at Rizzo's Protective Group. We're very excited about being ranked 10th out of the top 35 criminal justice podcasts as ranked and listed by FeedSpot. Hey, don't forget to subscribe to FeedSpot at www.feedspot.com. And please, por favor, per favore, visit our friends at https://newsly.me. Newsly is an audio app for iOS and Android. It picks up web articles about the most trending topics on the web at any given moment and reads them to you in a natural human voice. For the first time in the history of the internet, the entire web becomes listenable. You can browse articles from topics you choose and start playing. Hey, stop scrolling, start listening. You can follow any topic, as specific as you like, from sports, science, to Bitcoin. It'll find you the latest articles and read them to you. Hey, it's as easy as that. And to top it off, they have podcasts as well. Explore trending podcasts from over 50 countries. Our podcast, Light 'Em Up, is there too. I started using it as my default podcast app, and you can too. Download and use Newsly for free now from www.newsly.me or from the link in the podcast description liner notes and use the promo code Light 'Em Up. And Light 'Em Up in this case is spelled L1GHTEMUP. All one word. That's L1GHTEMUP. All one word.